Okay, we will be heard, I'm sure. I'm told the microphone is on, which means the tape may be recording, and if it is, we're all in trouble, so don't worry about it. Oh, Cheryl is translating. Very good. Oh, pardon me.
I thought it was...
So,
I don't want to yell. I want you to sit up. I'm not going to yell this speech, and there's no microphone to magnify my
voice. Maybe the one time I obey you, dear.
It's the end of everything.
You used up your credit.
That's it. I ruined it.
Okay, this is looking better and better.
Oh, much better, yes.
Better and better.
My voice is all gone. Oh, the pretzel maker.
I'll pick them up in a minute.
All right, thank you for moving up.
Welcome to the session entitled True Stories, Telling It Slant in Fiction and Poetry. I've forgotten the number of the session, but we're here, so what does it matter? I would like to introduce the panelists. I won't do a deep introduction because you have nice little bios in your programs. To my right is Paul Toscano, who will kick off this presentation. He can introduce his novel, which he is reading from. Next will be Cheryl Pace, who is with the beautiful earrings right there, and Don Houghton. Would you stand, Don? There you go. And I will bring up the rear. What we've got is two poets and two fiction writers. That doesn't really describe it. We've all written all kinds of stuff. But today, Cheryl and I are taking the poet role, and Paul and Don are reading from their fiction. With that, I think I'll just turn it over to Paul.
Thank you, Paul.
You're welcome.
I've written four novels. This one I call Christ on Trial and Easter Hymn. And I'll tell you first in a line what my purpose was. It's a first-person narrative, and I wanted to write a story that was a combination between A Christmas Carol and The Devil and Daniel Webster, and that I could use, that would be a piece of fiction that would be a set piece for Easter, the way A Christmas Carol has become for Christmas, although of course I know Charles Dickens, but that was my idea. The second thing I should tell you is that I'm going to actually read the second chapter, because it'll make more sense to you. But I will read a little of the opening first chapter, because there's some points there that need to be stated so you can understand the second one. To give you an idea of what the story is, so you get a general plot outline, is the story is a first-person narrative written by a lawyer like me in later life, and it's a reminiscence of a strange event that happened when he and his wife were much younger.
Can I briefly describe for a second? You may not want it, so please light the microphone closer to you.
And in the story, he has a near-death experience, and in this near-death experience, Christ appears to him and hires him to be his lawyer. That is, Christ hires Cliff to be his Christ's lawyer. In a trial that's basically the devil is the prosecutor and Christ is being tried for blasphemy, for putting himself higher than law, and for atrocities against humanity by not interfering to block pain and suffering. And I have this little structure to tell you, and that's that. So the rest of it, you'll have to follow along in the story. So chapter one, which I'll read just a page or so of, and then chapter two. Chapter one is called A Fine Kettle of Fish. The story I'm about to write happened over 20 years ago. It began on the night I died. I've told it only twice to some very close friends, but I've never been able to write it down. My wife, Anne, made detailed notes about it in her journal right after it happened, but I've never even been able to write anything past the first sentence.
Putting it on paper somehow makes it seem even more bizarre and unbelievable than it sounds to me in my head when I'm just thinking about it. Frankly, I wouldn't have believed it myself if Anne hadn't been a witness. Every so often, she has to reassure me that it wasn't some strange mutual hallucination. In the past few months, I've been having flashbacks that are vivid and detailed, and I get the feeling that something, or maybe someone, is pressing me to write about it. Why, I'm not sure. It may have something to do with aging, or with the kids being mostly grown, or with my deepening sense of obligation to leave them a durable record of the whole story from start to finish from my point of view, even if it makes me sound, well, goofy. I'm already having doubts about doing this, but at least I've made it past the first sentence. And then in the next section, it tells a little scene where Cliff and his wife Anne take their two daughters over to Cliff's parents' house. The mother made fish stew, and in the process of gobbling his dinner, which he does because his parents bicker all the time, Cliff chokes on a fish bone and can't get it out. And so Anne takes him to the hospital. He gags a lot, and so they have to give him an anesthetic, and that doesn't work. They have to put him under with sodium pentothal. He has a reaction to it and dies on the operating table, and that's where he has the next experience. So the last part of the first chapter basically says, the last paragraph to lead into the part I'm going to read. What followed in the next few moments is a bit fuzzy. I remember a nurse standing near me and babbling on about the anesthetic and the procedure. I remember that I didn't pay much attention. I was trying to keep my fear from ballooning into full-fledged terror. I remember feeling lonely. I thought of Anne and the girls. I vaguely recall a flurry of people in green gowns and antiseptic masks doing this and that, the smell of rubbing alcohol, the glint of light on the medical equipment. I remember being scooted off the gurney onto an operating table. My arm was stretched out. Someone started an IV drip. I remember clearly the prick of a needle in the gristle of between my knuckles. I can still see the hypodermic needle sticking into the back of my left hand. I remember an ice-cold surge shooting up my arm toward my shoulder. After that, I must have blacked out, but I didn't stay out. Chapter 2, My New Client. Suddenly, I was awake again. I didn't feel sick or groggy. My throat didn't hurt. In fact, nothing hurt. But I knew right away the operation wasn't over. The doctor and some nurses were looking down at me, their eyes wide, the lower parts of their faces covered with pale green cloth. At first I thought I was supposed to be awake. Maybe they'd given me only a local anesthetic. I should have paid more attention. So I decided to be as still and cooperative as possible and not gag. But what I saw next scared the hell out of me. The doctor reached up for his mask, but when he did, he moved in slow motion. I looked all around. Everyone in the room was moving in slow motion. Just then the light glared off the thin rubber glove on my doctor's hand. I saw his fingers stretched out as he slowly grabbed his green mask and pulled it down. His face was beaded in sweat. His mouth was open. He was shouting something, but I couldn't hear it. My ears were filled with a rushing sound, like wind whipping tree branches in a storm or the sound of a waterfall. I began to shake. Then somebody else moved, also in slow motion, a nurse. She was at my side, slowly pushing a hypodermic needle into my arm. I felt nothing. God, I thought, what's this? I've got to let them know I'm okay. I didn't know whether I could talk, but I was wide awake, so I shouted, listen, I'm fine. I feel all right. I could hear my own voice, no problem. But they obviously couldn't hear me because they took no notice of me and went right on. I shouted again, but it was futile. They went on moving, only now they seemed to be slowing down like mechanical toys on low batteries. I watched as they all turned away from me, and then they came to a stop. That's when I decided to sit up. I didn't know if I could do it, but I thought it might put an end to this nightmare if the gagger just sat up in the middle of his operation. I did it. By this time, the hospital people looked like they were frozen in place. I was trying to decide whether or not to jump off the table when I noticed my own hands. They were transparent. Holy shit, I shouted, and twisted myself around to look behind me and down at the operating table. What I saw terrified me. There I was, or at least there was my upper body, lying with my head cranked back, a stainless steel contraption crammed into my mouth, spreading my jaws open, and tubes running down my throat. My face was very pale. I felt a pulse of horror surge through my bones. Somehow I guess I should say my ghost, had gotten partially separated from my physical frame and had sat up out of the top of my body, while the bottom half of me, ghost and body, were still connected. "Oh God," I said, "I'm dead." These words were no sooner out of my mouth when the room suddenly filled with the brightest light I'd ever seen, as if the sun had come down out of the sky. I couldn't tell where the light was coming from. It was everywhere. Intense, pale gold. It should have hurt my eyes. Actually, it should have incinerated me, but it didn't. Instead, it changed everything. The upper part of me, the ghostly part that was sitting up, was no longer transparent. My hands, my arms, my chest now looked solid, but everything else in the room suddenly went see-through. The doctor, the nurses, the anesthesiologist, even the lower part of my body on the operating table. Then a voice spoke to me. "Clifford, you're not dead. Not quite," it said. Straight ahead of me, about 6 feet away from the foot of the operating table, I saw a vortex of light. In its center stood a man, only it wasn't a man. "Jesus Christ," I gasped. But I wasn't swearing. I was recognizing. I suppose I should have rolled off the table onto my knees and covered my face. Only I didn't. I felt weak all over, but very excited. I didn't move. I didn't speak. I stared. I could see now that he was the source of the light. It poured out of him in waves. At first, everything had seemed snow white. Then I began to see colors. His hair and his beard were red. I noticed this first, not carrot red, auburn, and smooth as silk, parted in the middle, every hair in place. It fell to his shoulders like I'd seen in artwork. But his face was like nothing I'd ever seen before, not in art, not anywhere. Even now, I could pick that face out of a crowd of millions. His eyes were large and dark. I couldn't tell their color. Maybe dark blue, I don't know. He wasn't very tall, just under 6 feet maybe. He wore a white robe extending from his neck to his ankles. It was so bright it seemed alien and alive. It should have blinded me, but it didn't. In that light, I don't think anything could have hurt me. He wore sandals on his feet, and he wasn't floating in the air looking down at me. He stood on the ground, and we were eye to eye. He had his hands clasped in front of him, and he wore a sash around his waist, tied on the right side. It was blood red. I didn't have to be told who this was. I knew it, and I knew he knew I knew it. I knew that then in a way I haven't known anything since. As the years have passed, my certainty has faded. I have more than once seriously doubted that this incident ever really happened in real time and space. It may have been just a fixture of my mind. I probably would have convinced myself long ago that it was a hallucination, except caused by the anesthesia, if it hadn't been for what followed. I remember his voice best of all. I've told this story twice before, and both times I said his voice was firm, but firm is the wrong word. I should have said his voice was solid. I can't do better than that. I can't even be sure now whether he actually spoke to me in my ears with sounds or in my mind with thoughts. "It won't take long," he said. "In a few minutes, you'll go back." "Back?" I said, confused. "Yes," he said, "after we've talked." "I guess I haven't been very good," I said defensively, though I hadn't really felt any judgment from him. "That's not it," he said. "I've come because I need your help." We stared at each other for a moment, surrounded by brightness and silence. "My help?" I said after a long pause in which I gaped at him in confusion. "Yes," he said, "I would like you to be my lawyer." My God, this must be a hallucination, I remember thinking. I'd heard about bad drug trips, but I'd never had one myself. I'd never tried anything stronger than pot, and that was only a few times in college. My weakness was single malt scotch. Besides, this didn't feel like any hallucination I'd ever heard of. I've tried over the years to figure out why it felt so real at the time and so dreamlike as time passed. Maybe because at the time I experienced this event with my mind, my body, and my spirit all at once, even though my body was comatose, my mind blown away, and my spirit dwarfed. Maybe it was the simultaneous knowing with all these parts of me that made me feel certain about it, but not later. Besides, at the time, my pompous, transparent doctor was still standing next to me in plain sight along with the other hospital people, all transparent and frozen in time, the very same people I'd seen when I'd first gone into the operating room. No, I still believe it wasn't an hallucination or practical joke or dream. To this day, even though I have moments of doubt, I still know on some deep level that the experience was real. Without the sense of certainty I had back then, I don't think I could have engaged with him. I would have been too distracted by the fear that I was suffering a mental breakdown. probably the delayed effect of too much masturbation and a little pot smoking in my wild days. As he stood there in front of me, I felt totally sane and focused and perfectly able to converse with him. "You want my help?" I said, incredulous. "Yes," he said. "This is very strange," I said. "I know," he said. "What's going on?" I asked. "I've been charged in a criminal case," he said, "and I want you to defend me." All I could do was give him a blank, dumbfounded look. "Satan is the prosecutor," he explained after a moment. "Satan?" I barked. "You mean there really is a Satan?" "Oh, yes," he said calmly. "Shit," I thought. Then I remember catching a movement out of the corner of my eye. It was the ghostly shape of a hypodermic needle being pulled very slowly out of my arm by a see-through nurse. The transparent people in the operating room had not really ground to a halt after all. They were still moving, but just barely. "What's wrong with them?" I asked. "We're standing in a slightly different field of time," he said simply. "Oh," I said, "weird. Will you do it?" he asked. "Do what?" "Be my advocate," he said. "I don't know," I said. "I don't even know what's happening to me. I'm lying here literally half dead, and you show up. In the last few minutes, I've learned there's a God, a devil, a life after death. I'm having a little trouble with all of this." At that, he walked round to the side of the operating table, passing right through my transparent doctor, leaned back against it, turned his head toward me, and said, "Let me explain." I remember thinking, "He's so informal." He smiled and went on. "Satan can't attack me directly, so he does it indirectly by attacking others. He seduces them, takes them hostage, sometimes terrorizes them. He wants me to retaliate against him with force, to assert my sovereignty the way he'd assert it if it were his. But if I did this, even for a moment, I'd become like him. That's why he's brought these criminal charges against me. He wants me to fight back with power." At this moment, I became distracted by my own thoughts. I realized I was on the verge of landing the biggest case of my legal career. I knew it was a petty thought, so I quickly shoved it aside. "Okay, let me get this straight," I said. "You've been charged with a crime by Satan." "Yes," he replied. I sucked in a deep breath. It didn't occur to me to wonder then why I was still breathing or what. "Well," I said, "considering who you are, why even bother answering the charges? Just ignore him." "I can't ignore him," he said. "I can't ignore anyone." "Why not?" "Because I am that I am," he said. I gave him another blank look. Why was he quoting Popeye, I wondered. I was biblically illiterate then, so his allusions to scripture went sailing right over my head. "Cliff," he said, "if I ignored Satan, if I insulated myself from his accusations, I'd begin to become what he says I am. The more I ignored him, the more his lies about me would cease to be lies, and that's what he wants." Some of this sunk in. "What exactly are the charges?" I asked after a moment. "There are two," he said, holding the end of one of the ties of his red sash and feeling the smoothness of the satin with his fingers. "The first is blasphemy. Satan claims it's blasphemous for me to put myself higher than law and to encourage the worship of myself as a person." "Well, who does he expect people to worship? Him?" I asked. "He says humans should be encouraged to worship not a being but certain principles such as justice, mercy, and love," he said. "Oh," I said. And then I thought that this didn't sound unreasonable, actually. "The second charge," he said, "is that I commit atrocities against humankind whenever I fail to intervene in human affairs to prevent evil and suffering. He says I'm the ultimate source of evil because I could but do not use my power to prevent it." "I see," I said diplomatically, not mentioning that the same idea had crossed my mind more than once in my life. "I don't know offhand what kind of a defense I could make," I added. "These aren't the kinds of charges I deal with usually." I remember thinking that this case would involve a knowledge of theology, not exactly my best subject. "Why don't you just defend yourself?" I asked. "If I did," he replied, "I would be bound to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, the infinite part of my nature, my foreknowledge of all possibilities, my omnipresence and omnipotence in the world, would overwhelm the court, reducing the trial to a contest of power. That's out of the question. Someone else has to present my case for me." "Why me?" I thought, but I didn't say it out loud, probably out of habit. A solo practitioner learns not to turn away business just because it happens to require a little research. "Look," I said candidly, "this is a big case. I'd like to take it very much. I don't get many big cases, but I don't know if I have the background you need. I'm not religious, which I suppose you know. Are you sure you have the right lawyer? I mean, you could get anybody." "I'm more interested in your character than your skills," he said. "Oh," I said. I didn't know whether to be flattered or insulted. I looked at him. I had already lost the sense of awe I'd felt when I'd first seen him. In fact, he was beginning to seem to me more or less ordinary, just another client almost, a very good one to be sure. I knew that I was talking face to face with God. It should have been a staggering moment, but I didn't stagger. I realize now that he didn't let me. If I defended you, I asked, how would I prepare? What would I be in for? What kind of a trial would it be? What kind of a court? The trial will take place in the celestial court, he said, straightening himself and turning toward me. Satan conceded for your sake that the trial will take place in English, and that the relevant portions of the federal rules of criminal procedure and of evidence will apply from the moment the jury is impaneled until the verdict is pronounced. Satan conceded, I said. Yes, he said. Why would he do that? I asked. Because of what I conceded to him, he said. And what's that? I asked. I agreed, he said matter-of-factly, that you wouldn't participate in the selection of the jury. No voir dire? That wasn't very smart, I said. You know, you can't count on a jury's random selection to ensure impartiality. Why on earth did you do that? He wouldn't accept any other terms, said my client. This seemed very strange to me. I'd always assumed that if there was a God, he wouldn't be inclined to negotiate, let alone make concessions. At this point, I absentmindedly attempted to get up from the operating table so I could pace around, but I couldn't move my legs. I'd forgotten all about the fishbone, the operation, my death. I looked around, aware again of my circumstances, and noticed that the transparent hospital people were slowly moving into a huddle around me. What's happening? I asked. They're trying to revive you, he said. Oh, I said. It didn't seem important. I was wondering how to get around the jury problem my client had created. Who's the judge? I asked. I am, he replied, but not in this case. Obviously, I couldn't sit as judge in my own case. So Satan and I agreed upon a judge. You agreed? My voice broke off. Is the judge your father? I ventured. No, my father and I are one, he said. I see, I said, not seeing anything. Who is it then? I promised Satan that you wouldn't know until the verdict is in, he said. You've made an awful lot of promises, haven't you? I said. He said nothing. This not knowing about the judge seemed very unfair, and I didn't mind telling him. I don't know how I can help you if you keep making deals. I can't be much of help if you don't cooperate. And as soon as I said it, I realized that I must have sounded to him like my throat doctor had sounded to me. So I cooled myself down. Look, I said, if we can't be absolutely sure the jury is impartial, we may have to rely on a ruling from the bench on a motion for a directed verdict or for a judgment notwithstanding the verdict. No, he said evenly, the verdict of the jury will stand. Once made, the federal rules will no longer apply. The judgment and the sentence will be pronounced under the rules of the heavenly court. There will be no post-judgment motions and no appeals. That's not fair, I said, irritated. These things have already been decided. If you take my case, you must take it where it stands, he said, his voice solid silver. Then he clasped his hands in front of him and looked down at the floor. I was being offered a very important case. So what if it wasn't perfect? What did I expect? I sure as hell wasn't going to let it slip away. What sentence are you facing, I asked. Death, he said. I was taken aback. You've already died, I said. You can only die once. Mortals can die only once. I can die many times, he said. You're serious? The sentence would really be carried out, I asked. Yes, he said, nodding. I sat there for a minute, trying to fathom this, and what does that mean, I asked. It means that Satan would triumph, he said. I was tempted to ask him if he was joking, but I didn't have to. I was certain he wasn't. In that case, I said, I want to be certain that I'm the attorney you want. There's a lot at stake. I've chosen you, he said. I didn't say anything for a while. He stood looking at me, waiting. He seemed very vulnerable. Then I noticed the wounds in his hands. They were still fresh. When does the trial begin? I asked. A little over a month from now, March 25th, he replied. That doesn't give me much time to prepare, I said. You'll do fine, he said in an optimistic way that made me uneasy. It was then I noticed that the ghostly forms of the hospital people were reaching to touch my body. The doctor's transparent hand began passing through the part of me that was sitting up as he reached toward the head of my body lying on the operating table. I tried to ignore these shapes and concentrate on my new client. I'll have to do some research, I said. Blasphemy is not a crime anymore down here, which I'm sure you know. And as for committing atrocities, I don't have any idea of how to make a defense to that. Something will occur to you, he said. You'll have a few days to think about all this as you're getting well, and will be a great help to you. How much help can you give me? I asked. Well, I can bring certain ideas to your attention, he said, and I can summon to the court any witnesses you choose, whether living, dead, or unborn. Unborn? How could I pick somebody unborn? I asked, frustrated. Well, he said calmly, maybe you should ignore that option and look to the present and the past. Remember, though, that we can only call three. The trial can only last one day, one of your days, so we'll be limited to just three witnesses. That's quite a restriction, I said. Yes, but it limits the prosecution, too, he said. I mulled this over and then ventured, will I get the help of, I didn't know exactly how to ask this. Can I help, count on the help of angels, he said, catching my drift. No, I'm afraid you would find them unreliable and a bit trying. I looked at him. Really? I said, really, he said. Will you take the stand if I call you, I asked. No, he said. All these negatives felt very confining. If you want me to be your lawyer, you should let me control the conduct of the case, I said. He didn't respond. I waited a moment. Is there anything else you can do for me, I asked. I can give you the assurance, he said, that Satan will be bound to conduct his case according to the rules. There will be no terror, no great manifestations of power. Neither he nor his cohorts will trouble you or your friends or relatives, either before, during, or after the trial, regardless of the outcome. I did get him to make those concessions. I stared at him for a moment. I never considered any of these possibilities. Thanks, I said. Don't mention it, he said. Even so, I wish I could count on you for some kind of assistance in preparation. You're a good lawyer, Cliff. You'll do fine, he said. I stared at him and thought, how many of my classmates, especially the ones who'd made law review, could claim a personal reference from God? But I realized I could never put it on my resume. After you've recovered, he said, I'll visit you again, and Anne too. I knew he was winding up. I searched my mind for anything else I needed to know. There was something, but all I could think to ask was an irrelevant question. The fishbone thing, it wasn't an accident, was it? No, not from my perspective, he said. But why, I asked. If you hadn't accepted my case, he said, this would be to you just a fading dream. Oh, I said. Then the light gathered about him, forming a column above his head. He rose from the floor. The light in the room grew dim. The people around me became solid while my ghostly part became transparent, and all the while I felt myself gently being pressed backward into my body. Suddenly he was gone. And in that same brief moment I felt, as if for the first time, the weight of my flesh and bones upon me and the giddy coursing of blood in my veins. And then I remembered. Damn it, I thought. I never said a thing to him about my fee. But it was too late. I was overcome with exhaustion and fell into a deep sleep. Well, just to let you know, in the story, it's not an hallucination, and he has to convince his wife, and she kind of believes him, and after a while they prepare, and then you get to the trial, and there's actually a trial, and there's Satan there looking very, you know, very elegant and GQ, and he calls, the witnesses that Satan calls are Bertrand Russell and Hermann Göring and the Cliff's wife Anne's father. And Cliff calls, but without any opportunity to do a pre-deposition of these people, he calls Abraham out of the Old Testament. I had a lot of fun with these witnesses coming in. And St. Paul out of the New Testament, and then he calls his own wife, Anne. So what happens in the story is that even though it seems like it's going to be solely a trial, I try to avoid the split in the story between the characters, Cliff and Anne, and the actual story. Actually, they become witnesses, and their lives come out, and things that they did that they didn't each know come out in the trial. And then it wraps up with a slightly unexpected conclusion. So that's my little novel. Thanks.
Cheryl Pace.
That's going to be hard to follow. Thank you for being here. I have to find some glasses. These are just poems. They're not connected. And the first one is called The Transubstantiation of Stone.
Pull the mic a little closer, Cheryl.
Okay. Okay. there was a man made of marble, chiseled, polished, and perfectly placed, until the day he began to move, slowly, imperceptibly. He was taking on life, and we who admired him never noticed the hand once resting against his own body, suddenly reaching out for ours, his mouth moving to shape words. A perfect man was on the move from one lily-white pose to the next, and so we willingly forgot that yesterday he was next to a bed of roses, and today he was next to nothing. Our eyes were ever fixed upon the perfect spine of an oh-so-subtly twisted torso. We ran our fingers freely over his toes. He was so balanced, so perfectly balanced. He was as steady as a rock, as steady as only rock can be, and turning pink, warming with the afternoon sun. Oh, yeah, we thought it was the sun, and never remarked the hedge getting closer, or his chest pulsing where the heart of a man might be. We never remarked the presence of pink long after sunset in the shadows of the encroaching living wall. Yet it was as this work of art came to life and tried to leave the garden that love began the chase, and she worked another of her unforgiving miracles. What did I imagine I would do with flesh? Did I really imagine I could take the heat of a fire that burned so hot it was turning marble into man? I won't know.
We'll all sense it.
This one is called The Eye of the Storm. I know a lot about them. I was raised on an island and on the water, so hurricanes, know about those. At the heart of high pressure, there is the eye of the storm, window to the soul of fear. And wind rages all around her. And to be a mote in fear's eye is not more than to swim in the calm of her illusion. To follow her out to sea, to lose velocity until, with an imperceptible sigh, one is dispersed across the surface and there is nothing left of fear and her companion but a headline from yesterday's news. Those of us who have lived on an island in the always path of every hurricane were children born without choice to island life. And the first lesson we learned at the knees of the wise was to float and be so very still, to let the eye go by, to ride the wind-ravaged waves like green twigs whenever the tide took the high ground out from under us. Yeah, just really don't have to clap. Just wave your arms around.
You feel. We don't have to clap. If we clap, it means we wanted to.
Oh, the hour of our consolation. The hour of our consolation brings us as close as breath to death herself. On muddy knees, at last, thank God, in a not-so-gentle rain. Consolation finds us like raindrops in our eyes that for one brief storm demand that we look down, away from heaven and into hell. And we cling to the view of it, willingly plunge soft, manicured fingers back into the wet earth from whence they came. In the perfect storm, at that perfect hour, one's ground holds, and he who will can touch all things. Today's roots, tomorrow's seeds. In the perfect storm, there is no sun and no moon. There is only the earth in shades of gray, veiled in tears, her last most noble rite. In the perfect rain, there are only dirty hands consoled by blurry vision, and there is mud, our last most noble rite, after the perfect storm, after. When companions bear fruit, by the fruits of their labor you shall know them, and by the fruits of your labor, and one perfect, consoling rain, you shall know us all. Thank you. That sounded so yummy. The paid companion. He will abide your grief while you abide your time, until the time has come when grief expressed is grief truly understood. And then this companion, paid to mourn by appointment and for his knowledge of every ritual under sun and sanctuary, will abandon your hour. The burial, he informs his critics, is always outside the gates of fair expectations. In truth, there is no point to his presence past the fanfare. All things visible. It is an afternoon like any other, and other than the spirit in the room, uneventful. For as quietly as death itself, whatever among the dead that was once moved by the hour can claim the hour again, and sometimes does, passes on, passes by, and sometimes through the woman in her chair, who stops mid-thought. Her husband, in passing, stops mid-step to look. He looks, she looks, and then they look away from all things invisible, for on this and every uneventful afternoon, they are so uncommonly attached to their common understanding and to their common commitment to all things visible. This is a very old one. It's called Divine Affairs. In the lingering shadows of eternal afternoon tea, God carefully disrupts his melancholy. He materializes one translucent eye, arches the spine of his spirit, and breathes into space one soundless sigh. Even he was once a child, giving life to lumps of clay. But while in the hands of his divinity, clay became birds, in the hands of his infancy and his arrows, birds became prey. He shuts a weary eye to relive the moment when the Virgin Mary gave him life, delivered his curiosity into cold night air, denied the anesthesia of love, that he as man might hoard an anesthesia of innocence. He brings a foot into being, and with an angry stride steps out of nothing and calls her to his side. She comes into focus, tour en l'air, and leaves a trail of light fading where now she's tossed long shadows into a damp glade. He joins her there and succumbs to his defense. She, with a fleeting smile, breathes mushrooms on a split rail fence. Moonrise, nightfall, he leans her way. Behold, he whispers, what creatures do who are used to day. She conjures up box seats, and they, among the apathetic creatures of the night, watch two little humans, predator and prey. The beauty of them can hardly be denied, he proudly says aside, and she, applauding, replies, one dies. Thank you, Paul. Shall I keep going?
Yep.
Okay. She is a stay-at-home, her homely occupation. She is a stay-at-home wife and mother who, between a morning exodus and dinner din, sweeps away with a rag the very skin of her loved ones, those makers and shakers of dust. Dust that settles like rings around the moon in obedience to her. A woman with nothing but a cloth in her hand, who, in the homely act of sitting to survey her accomplishments, traps beneath her weight the dust of their dimensions and hers. and yet she is not less than a queen, in perpetual demand, who determines their progress like no other, and will, until death do all of them part, open the door, shut the door, oil the hinges, keep the dust circulating through empty rooms like blood through an empty heart. Couple more at least. Couple more. A man of his word. What God has made will only be as good as his word. He will be word itself, image of the divine and descendant of the fallen come into the world. An act of God will seal him to his own, who will worship and glorify him. Pray he will not believe as they would have him believe. Thus would he be lost in a maze of his own veins, drowning in blood ties, a man with no voice, coursing the way of saints to damnation. One more. Ring a bell. We walked on walls. Good walking walls were made of stone, poorly laid and capped with crumbling cement, all heaves and cracks. Down east, there's always walking walls that run along the sea. They separate two ruts of a road from that inevitable fall to the rocks and certain death, the fall that Mother mentioned every morning. We knew rocks, and we knew that once you were out there on the rocks, a simple turn of the tide could deliver you to the deep. But those of us anywhere near the sea walked the walls anyway. And children that we were, we loved walking above it all. We hung St. Christopher's on shoestrings around our necks, and we took in the natural horizon. Every day was a day as far as the eye could see, along the surface of a churning, white-capped world, dark, deep, forbidding. Every day was a day as far as the eye could see, until we outgrew walls and shoestrings. And one day, suddenly, the patron saint of travelers was not a saint. The Pope said so. So we were afraid, that's true, but we were all grown up anyway, bigger, hairier, embarrassed. So we jumped off the wall, some to the ruts, some to the rocks, none to a wider view, of course. And all of us, either way, taking out a sea rose or two on the way down, one with arms and elbows, another with his knees, one crushing flowers with his big boy feet, another smushing rose hips with her big girl bottom. Mm-hmm. Am I done now? Thank you. Thanks, guys.
Don Hooken.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Don.
Hello.
I'm going to read a short story called Pure, and it's actually a chapter in my novel. It's deep in the novel, but it still stands alone, so I don't think I need to tell you anything except it's set in the 70s. And it actually first appeared in I don't know if anybody read the in Our Lovely Deseret, an anthology that came out about 11 years ago. It was in there. Pure. My mom claims Marilyn Monroe is the Mary Magdalene of her generation, misunderstood and angelic. So she goes about thinking of ways to save Marilyn's soul. Instead of a usual Monday family night where we talk about charity or honesty, we wait until the weekend and we watch Marilyn movies. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, How to Marry a Millionaire, Some Like It Hot, Bus Stop, and The Misfits at the Avalon Theater on State Street, using our first of the month check each time. It is the 15-year anniversary of Marilyn's death. My mom says 7-year itch doesn't have good moral values because it's about the temptation of affairs and because of the scene where Marilyn's dress blows up in the air. Plus, it's one of Marilyn's ex-husbands, Joe DiMaggio, didn't approve of, so we don't watch that one. My mom starts going crazy doing genealogy. She makes each of us our own book of remembrance with our names on the front and a drawing of our family tree on the first page. She says that on Sundays, doing genealogy is a way of keeping the Sabbath holy. The family tree in my book of remembrance says that my dad is Charles Derrick. My mom says it isn't anybody's business who my real dad is. What's legal is what counts, she says. Besides my mom, stepdad, Moroni, Rachel, Grace, and our grandparents, uncles and aunts, there isn't anyone else on the family tree. My mom discovers that Marilyn's real name was Norma Jean Mortensen at birth, and then Baker, and that Monroe was Marilyn's grandfather's name, which went all the way back to James Monroe, the 5th President of the United States. We have pictures of Marilyn cut from magazines and collected by my mom's best friend, Sister Sylvester. The pictures are from The Enquirer and Hollywood Yesterday and Today. One is of Marilyn as a child with Easter clothes on, and there's another where she's an adult wearing a flower dress standing in front of a swimming pool for her last movie, Something's Got to Give. My mom pastes them in her own book of remembrance with captions that read, Norma Jean, Face of a Distraught Child, and Marilyn, shortly before her untimely death. Note, movie never completed. My mom tells us things about Marilyn, like that she was sensitive and intelligent, and that Arthur Miller wouldn't have married a knucklehead. Even though my mom says Arthur Miller was a real catch, she says her favorite husband of Marilyn's was Joe DiMaggio, a man who was caring as any, the proof of which is an item she cut out of Ripley's Believe It or Not paperback. She pastes the unbelievable item alongside a photo of Marilyn drinking Coke from a bottle. It says that Mr. DiMaggio faithfully put roses on Marilyn's grave once a week. My mom's number one goal is to make Marilyn a Mormon, but she's been told that only a relative can request that. Once, when a woman claimed she was Marilyn's daughter in Star Magazine, my mom wrote and asked for permission to have Marilyn's temple work done, meaning make Marilyn a Mormon through baptism and so forth. The daughter actually wrote back, but with the answer no, and to leave her family alone because they'd been through enough already. But somehow, my mom proves to the deciders high up in the church that we are related to Marilyn as distant cousins. She does it by finding a Monroe in our family tree and adding as many other Monroe names in the middle until it comes to her own dad, my grandpa Greneau, whose third cousin married a Monroe, M-U-N-R-O. The day my mom gets the letter with her name typed on the front from the church office building in Salt Lake City, she won't open it until she pulls out her book of remembrance and looks at one of Marilyn's pictures glued toward the front. In the photo, Marilyn has brown hair and freckles on her nose, and she's wearing a blouse with long sleeves and a high collar. My mom reads the letter under her breath, but when she gets to the part saying she can do the temple work, she reads it out loud and slowly, and then reads it again, but this time even louder and slower. I have never seen my mom so happy as that day. Her neck is pink, and she is walking on tiptoes around our living room. She's giggling. She puts Marilyn's baby picture that she cut out of a magazine from the dentist's office and glued to a piece of cardboard on the piano and starts singing the song Come Come Ye Saints. Though hard to you this journey may appear, all is well, she sings. It is one of her favorite church hymns. It is about the pioneers making their way to Utah. We sing it too, all of us, except my sister Rachel, who never sings anything. Marilyn's baby picture falls off of the piano and lands on my mom's lap. Then my mom says a thank you prayer. On Sunday, before sacrament meeting, my mom tells a few sisters and brethren about the possibility of Marilyn becoming a Mormon. We are in the foyer. I am passing out programs and getting pats on the head for it. Grace is standing close to my mom. Moroni and Rachel are sitting and sliding on the back pew. I see two of the brethren raise their eyebrows and smirk like they've just heard a nasty joke. Do you think she'll accept it? One of the sisters asks, meaning accept being Mormon. She won't accept it, not with her morals, Sister Edwards whispers. Marilyn was a beautiful person, my mother says to Sister Edwards. Sister Edwards makes a sound to let my mom know she thinks we're nuts. She walks away and loses her shoes, her shoe, but instead of putting it back on, she picks it up and keeps walking right by me and into the chapel without taking a program. I follow Sister Edwards to the front of the chapel and put a program next to her when she sits down. "You're sweet," she says, and takes a deep breath. My mom checks out books on Marilyn's life from the library. My favorite book about Marilyn is one with a pink cover and Marilyn making a kissing face. Inside, in the middle, there's a picture of Marilyn with her hand behind her head, and she's naked. I look at the picture a lot. My mom says it's too bad that Marilyn had to start out having pictures taken in such a vulnerable way. She also says Marilyn has a perfect body. I'm old enough to do baptisms for the dead in the temple. The rule is to be at least 12. My mom wants me to do Marilyn's baptism. She says it's something I'll remember and be proud of my whole life. I like Marilyn. I memorize a poem she wrote about a willow tree and imitate her soft voice from the movie Bus Stop. And I like the kind of funny, daring person she was in Some Like It Hot. On the day we go to the Salt Lake Temple to do Marilyn's baptism, the bus driver compliments both my mom and I on our dresses when we put our change in the meter. I think of how he doesn't know I'm about to do something important and how he's important for taking us downtown. I'm missing school for this, but it's a good reason. Marilyn could be watching us right now. Imagine how excited she is, my mom says during the bus ride. After she says that, I feel a little scared and I wonder if Marilyn's ghost will haunt me. We get off of the bus by the main post office downtown and walk two blocks. Around the outside of the temple is a tall stone wall. There are places to enter Temple Square as a visitor, to look at flowers, or go inside the tabernacle and hear the choir practice their songs, or go inside the visitor center and look at pictures of Jesus and his apostles and lions with lambs. Inside the visitor center on the second floor, there's a big white statue of Jesus, taller than a house, and Jesus' arms are out, and all around him are stars and planets, and in his hands are the scars from the nails used to put him on the cross. It's the statue that Vincent's brother Ron threw the rock at when he went crazy. The temple looks like a castle, gray and pointy, made of granite, and on top is the tall gold statue of the angel Moroni, who my brother is named after. 40 years to build, my mom says. I know, I answer. I'm just saying, can you believe it? 40 years. I'm not even 40 years. I don't answer because we are at the side door to the temple, and people are quietly entering. My mom points down a hallway and lets me walk in front of her to a desk where a man in white clothing waits to look at my temple recommend, a small piece of paper signed by the bishop. We walk down a hall that feels like a tunnel, but with lights and the kind of tile floors schools have. A gray-haired woman, also in white clothing, greets us. She's not wearing a ring or a necklace. We are inside now. There are white walls and high ceilings and carpet. It is quiet and clean. The woman takes us to the ladies' dressing room where there are benches and lockers. She asks me if I'm on my period. I say no, and my mom tells her I haven't even started for the first time yet, and the woman shakes her head and smiles at me, and I wish my mom hadn't said that. I go inside a dressing stall and hang my blue corduroy jumper and yellow cowl neck blouse up in a locker. I put on a white jumpsuit, and my mom, who is now dressed in white too, helps zip up the back. Mary's named after Marilyn, Mary with an I. That makes it all the more special, my mom tells the woman in white who stands smiling with her hands clasped in front of her. Yes, the woman says softly. Two other women, both wearing white dresses and white pantyhose, walk me to the baptismal font. The font is held up by sculptures of big gold oxen standing in a half circle. I walk up the painted white metal stairs. Three other people in white clothing, two men, rush to the top of the platform once I step down into the water. I hear a murmur of voices. I hear Marilyn's name. The people on the platform want to watch Marilyn's baptism. They smile at me like they're my grandparents. After the man who stands in the water with me says a prayer and says the name Norma Jean Baker, because that's Marilyn's official name growing up, the man dunks me all the way under the water. I pop up to the sound of soft claps, and some people even have both hands to their mouths, as if my coming back up is a miracle. Once, my mom told me that if a person is really happy that you've done their temple work, they'll show their appreciation by making your face change to look like theirs for a split second. So I say, "Do I look like Marilyn now?" And the people on the platform laugh, and my mom stands at the top of the steps and smiles and nods her head yes. Her eyes are puffy and pink, and she holds a tissue up to one side of her nose. I dry my hair in the locker room and change back into my jumper and cowl neck. We go to Walgreens restaurant just down the street to share a grilled cheese sandwich and Sprite at the counter. While we eat, my mom tells me she thinks that Marilyn accepted it and that she'll thank me in heaven for what I did. She also says that we'll probably all be friends someday. When the check comes, I wonder if my mom has enough money. Back at our trailer, my mom says she has to pick the kids up from Mrs. Yang's. I like it with just the two of us, so I say, listen to one thing, and she says she will, but just one thing. Then she walks around the house drying dishes and crying to Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road album borrowed from Linda Mercer's Brothers collection. I play the song Candle in the Wind because it's about Marilyn. For a while, my mom leans in the kitchen doorway with the dish towel at her hip and listens to the song. She makes a soft, pouty face with her eyelids half closed and her lips pushed out when Elton John sings how Norma Jean never knew who to cling to when the rain set in. Then my mom stares, in the same hopeless way Marilyn did in The Misfits, when Clark Gable went a little crazy with the horses, sort of sad and lost, with nothing left to look forward to.
Hard acts to follow indeed. Thank you. Thank you all. And thank you all for coming. And there are three people I want to thank especially who came. And if you notice a little teaser in the bio I submitted for this session, I mentioned that I've been working on a book for a year, and which has the working title of Slapped: Defiant Housewives on the Banks of the Jordan. And three people who I've been working with on that book are here, and I'd like them to stand, and I will introduce them to you. That's you guys. Please stand, please. Judy Feld on my left, Brent Fouts, and Jenilee Tobias. I'm doing this because who knows, we might be doing something next year at some time. So let's wait and see. A few months ago, I've been working with my brothers and sisters on my father's and mother's biographies, and came across a document in my father's cache of papers that told a sort of a story that I was totally unfamiliar with, and I think my siblings were unfamiliar with it too, and it seemed to imply that my father at one time had been called to serve as an unofficial chronicler of the to make a survey of the trees on the grounds of the Logan Temple and to describe what they were and where they came from and that sort of thing. And as I read that, it simply had a description of each major tree on the grounds. I don't know. Something in there suggested there might be a poem, and it took a few months, actually, for it to emerge. And this poem is called The Garden. Called as temple guide, my dad, more horticulturist than botanist, was sent outside to list and catalog the temple garden's trees, asked to provide an almanac of mystery, lost secrets and attractions of a far-flung arboretum, some of nature's knowledge. Like the tree of life, some were metaphorical and bore a painful fruit. The butternut, my father wrote, must be grown from seed, cannot withstand a transplant. Ornamental reach is grand, but often dies in infancy. Arched back-to-back, black sugar maple and larch tamarack, the former, only one in Utah, sweet to see in mountain symmetry. Larch's fibrous roots, he noted, were used to keep the river water out of Hiawatha's bark canoe in Longfellow's poetry. My memory, still haunted by a bollocksed proxy baptism on Temple Hill, mistakenly sent chill and dripping from the font to the wrong dressing room. My long, wet hair had veiled my eyes. Strange, the sudden shame in dawning guise of opposite. Out there, in the garden, surprised to learn, in searching my dad's notes, still grows the maidenhair, or ginkgo. Was wisdom the elusive nut the Chinese found inside its pulpy droops? Is this tree, thought to be the oldest in the world, an ancient sign of mother? Witness tears shed in the garden, silent dirge of weeping cherry, weeping willow, cut leaf, weeping birch. Assume the grief is for the recklessness of modern times, when crude machine was lowered through the temple roof to bulldoze walls and raise the mural in the garden room. Ordinary people, once adorned as Adam, Eve, the serpent, God, breathed life into creation's tale, replaced instead by faces on a movie screen. Just beyond the reach of cinematic Eve, the garden's flowering peach trees, one white, one pink, one red. As a girl, my sister May hiked Temple Hill and sat beneath a tulip tree to write her verse. Was it there that she rehearsed creation's impulse, later to invent a universe of forests, heavens, visions, creatures, passions, seas? Her father's daughter, a goddess in the garden. Bye. Thank you. I'll just mention that a new book on Mae Swenson, which is called Body My House, which is a line from her poem Question, has appeared from Utah State University Press in the last 2 months. It's a collection of essays by major critics and poets around the world that were delivered at the Mae Swenson Symposium 2 years ago in Logan. And another book is also being published this fall by USU Press, which is the use of a single poem of hers, one of the more anthologized poems called The Centaur. Illustrations have been done, and it's to be released as a children's book. It'll be out, I believe, next month. I believe so, yes. All right, thank you. 2 years ago, no, 1 year ago at Sunstone, we had a panel of this kind, and fiction and poetry people. And one of the people on that panel was, I'm getting a little confused. This was 2 years ago, actually. Lorraine Wilkins was on that panel. And then last year at Sunstone, I attended a panel that she was on and said goodbye to her as she left the room, and it was the last time I saw her. She was killed in a tragic accident that also injured her daughter very badly. Lorraine Wilkins was a member of the Mormon literary community that will be remembered for a long time, and her poems are exceptional. And Irriantum has published recently published some poems of hers, and I'm hoping that a book of her stuff will be put together, because it's terrific. So about a month after that, after her death, another friend of hers, Marv Hamilton, who's a musician, a singer-songwriter, and a dear friend of Lorraine's for an intense period of time, called me up one day, and I went with him on a car trip to Antelope Island. I hadn't been there for years, and his reason for asking me was he was really bereft about Lorraine. And when we came back from that trip, Later on, we found we both had written poems about that trip. And this poem of mine, I wish I had Marv's to read you because it's extremely strong. This is called Traces of Lorraine. On the causeway, on the way to Antelope Island, a strange new view. Dark ribbon of road slices through double-sided endless blue. Memory stained by traces of Lorraine, enigmatic pastel faces, celestial tears from a poem called All Tight Right Here. Slung low over the water, chunks of cloud reflect as glaciers. From his place in the rear seat of Marv's Toyota, Prayer Dog rests his head on my shoulder, gulps pale scene of dead sea, close sky, featureless infinity through dog eyes. Just ahead on the island, what is it Shizumi senses when he moans? Ageless beasts with shaggy, handsome heads, their tawny hides redolent of sage. And yes, there are antelopes on Antelope Island. They lope along gnarled slopes of desert floor as bright hen pheasant suddenly presents itself to soar past our windshield. At the Bison Point Bistro, Marv's cooler yields strawberry lemonade in a can. Huge plastic bison glows in the sun. We stand on a bluff overlooking rough country and placid surf. Prayer Dog, nosing northeast, assumes prayer pose. Just a year ago today, Marv says, from beneath his Red Sox cap, he and Lorraine were together at Fenway. After the semi jackknifed in Idaho, where Guy, another friend of Lorraine's, Lorraine and Lena couldn't avoid the crash, Lorraine held on for a week in ICU. Then, despite what she was forced to leave, did the road to celestial blue float as straight and true as this causeway we take back? All tight right here, she wrote. Okay, this is a real change of pace. I hope it's not too jarring. I look at Mormon blogs occasionally. They're fascinating. There's a particularly good one called Feminist Mormon Housewives, which often has incredibly interesting stuff. And this poem came out of a blog on that site that I thought was very uncharacteristic in some ways of what I usually find on Feminist Mormon Housewives. Although the people who commented didn't all have this view, but a number of them did. I mean, this view. I don't know if I'm correctly representing a view, but the topic was modesty, and so I've called the poem "The Modesty Blog." Modesty is the hottest topic in the blogernacle. The body is a tabernacle and must be covered by a sack or tent in order to prevent the baring of a shoulder or of skin above an older woman's ankle. If you are female, what you're wearing may be sin. If it inflames the lust of Mormon males whose lonely struggle with testosterone entails that they avert their eyes or disguise awareness of a woman's bust or thighs. Not only men are penitent about forbidden thoughts that may arise from tight, revealing clothing. Heterosexual married woman writes that she is flustered by immodesty. Won't notice breasts of women clad in modest tees, she says, but please avoid a clingy shift, especially if it's cold. Catch my drift. Some bloggers hasten to confess a secret yearning for a sundress, or self-consciously disclose they burn to wear J. Crew, as liberated women do. A few still grieve they bought the obligation to venerate the sleeve as sanctified when they put on the Mormon vestments of a bride. When slogging through the product of male blogs, observe a certain reticence to gauge appropriateness of manly dress, except the rightness of white shirts and ties, which leaves guys free to contemplate indecent penchants of their mates. Tim scathingly complains he can't imagine why their mothers can't refrain from dressing little girls in two-piece bathing suits. Another dense galoot alludes to a distressing prevalence of non-wife nudity. Forgive my rudeness if I see beauty in the human form and do not look away. Show me the marbled limbs of lovers in Rodin's The Kiss and Pray, the full-blown masculinity of David by Michelangelo. Artists who sculpted us to model God and goddess may find idolatrous and pat fixation on false modesty. Blog that. Okay, this is a strange poem. I don't know what to say about it. I noticed the water became part of it early and kept happening. So I'm calling it wet behind the ears. There used to be a swimming establishment north of Logan called Logana. Logana, where I didn't learn to swim. Couldn't take the plunge, although Brother Roy tried his damnedest to teach me how to snatch a breath without a chaser of chlorine, ignore the grunge that clung like algae to the bottom of the pool. Fort Ord, where I didn't learn to shoot. Shine my boots to sweat out one auspicious run when crazy fool Sergeant Cartagena used his stick to pick apart the ligaments and cartilage inside my knee, sent me to hospital for intravenous shots of Kingston Trio. Aboard the Gripsholm, couldn't quite succeed in swallowing Atlantic when it rose up to crack the whip, smash the glass of every window on the ship. In Sweden, broke another part, fragile organ called the heart, to christen launch of Mormon mission. Norrköping, Malmö, Helsingborg, Borås, the latter rainiest of any town in Europe. Morosely, couldn't find the water in all of Sweden to baptize more than two or three. Asked to leave the font for want of garments to the knee. Chose salty tears to comfort me. I didn't go through the temple before I left because I went with my parents, and so the first baptism, somebody called me out of the font and said, "Why aren't you wearing your garments?" So I simply explained. Okay. Again, a real change of pace. This is a recent poem. It's called Girly. Male word like bitch, for which there is no male equivalent, yet now acceptable in female mouths. Bent, since it implies a longing to converse, immunity to blandishments of football, or worse, susceptible to think in shocking ways that make the color pink a scandal. How does one handle femaleness? Consider womanly a word one should avoid, since it suggests a certain strength that might outlive the privileged length of male domination. It must be surely providential the fairer sex is rendered vulnerably devoid of intellect by girly. Judging by its usefulness, odd the word emerged late in the game rather than early. Makes plain the gulf between the sexes, one cute and frivolous, the other meant to flex authority. If one must come clean about its roots, trace the etymology to 50s magazines, once euphemistically called girly. If you are male and straight, not curly, it may not be too late to claim that one's testosterone ensures we're not to blame for cruelty and war. For safety's sake, fake a taste for movie gore and shun the works of Meryl Streep in flicks for chicks, since sentiment is girly. Thank you. This is a controversial poem. Some of you may like it, some of you may not. I don't mean any disrespect. It came all in one gulp. I'm not sure what all of it means. It's called The Brethren. Next time I read that, could whoever did that say it again? I mean, that sets it up. The Brethren, breathe an air that must be rarefied, male by definition, preach contrition to the cistern and the brothers who are other than the brethren. Sen, tucked beneath the tongue, sweetens every breath and masks the threat of death, since none are young and once removed will elevate another to their ranks. Their words are sacrosanct and can be stored in reservoirs or tanks, silently and deep. The cistern train their daughters to keep out of sight and carry water for the brethren. I ended it early. There's another stanza. I'm sorry. Shirts are white. Suits are blue or black. They sit in red-backed chairs, assured they're something more than brothers. It must be lonely there. When will they own their separateness? The brethren. Oh, gosh. I am plunging from one end of the spectrum to the other. I don't know how I react to this either. This is... okay. A line from this poem appeared in the abstract to lure you in. So, the bath. She asked to use the bathroom. Should I have asked, what for? Euphemism is assumed. If one departs the party room, one shouldn't need to specify. One's need to urinate behind closed doors. Should the supplicant be female, propriety demands that should we picture her? It is before the glass in order to refresh her face or gloss her lips or wash her hands. One doesn't count the trips a guest negotiates the hall to use the bathroom. Nicolette was absent from the fest for stretches of the gala night. After I thought the guests had gone, I saw a beam of light reflected on the tiled bathroom floor. No doubt I should have knocked, but as I cracked the unlocked door and flipped the switch, I heard a tiny gasp and swish of water in the dark. I gasped myself, returned illumination to the room, and couldn't help but notice Nicolette reclined inside the tub, one graceful leg with tufts of foam extended past the fixture's chrome, the other submarine to green-veined water. She held a razor in her hand, her toes pointed confusion in my face. Her look was not reproach, rather hinted she was in a lather to resume her languorous task. She did not ask my pardon, but razor poised, seemed to wait for me to say my piece or make my move. Through the louvered window from our garden, a whiff of jasmine drifted in. Beside the door, neatly stacked, her clothes and shoes, I turned the knob and breathed a single word. Excuse. We never talked about that night. It seemed illusion or a dream. When I encountered Nicolette, we chatted easily and let the past evaporate. One cold December at a party for the holidays, I left the guests to find my coat and thank my hostess, Nicolette. Instead, distracted, lost my way and found a sumptuous bath and lavish tub. A candle glowed like memory in the room. I locked the door, shut off the light, took off my clothes, and let hot water flow. Okay. That ended that. This is a recent poem. It's called Soft Cell. pop-up ad inside my head informs me as I lie in bed that I've been chosen as a test case for a bleak new marketing technique. Now my dreams are sponsored by SUVs, light beers, and lawyers who nightly pitch the benefit of injury. Eyes leak real tears that gratify me instantly and calm my fears of heart disease and bankruptcy. Aging weathermen and erstwhile jocks hawk microscopic hearing aids. And unctuous guys in dark attire attest that after I retire, they will be eager to provide the box in which I can be laid to rest. Be warned, but of good cheer. Soon it will be useless to resist commercialism's last frontier. Once your eyelids have been commandeered to ballyhoo Lunesta, you will be more than willing to invest a fortune to test a brand new remedy for impotence, or try at least a week for gratis. When frat boys push Bud Light as primal fluid to lubricate your love life, roll over and embrace your status as a stud. Obviously, it's no surprise Madison Avenue is keen to use the private life of Dream to advertise. Should you believe by camping out in nature, far away from commerce and its alluring nomenclature, you can escape seductive images of movie stars extolling Cadillacs and other luxury cars or savoring the best cigars, it's not that easy. Safe inside your sleep sacks in the woods, lulled to slumber by a mountain stream, be apprised. Consumer goods will find you and subsidize your dreams. Okay, this is the last poem, and I don't think I'll lead into it. It's called My Son Came Back. My son came back to me, waved from a back table at the Village Inn. Although he turned down breakfast, sat and let me buy him coffee. "Hi, Dad," he said. Broke a fast and fed on that. Doesn't matter that he's shed the Jonathan. His name is Johnny now. Wrote it and his cell phone number on the flip side of a hatter's card that bears a picture of the cowboy hat he wears. Hands scorched by welder's torch and rope burns from his grandpa's ranch. Castrates calves some weekends. Earns the right to laugh or grouse at city slicker slacker cousins holed up in the bunkhouse. Amps, not volts, he tells me, stamps his trade as dangerous. No fuss, he plans to weld his skills to academe and at the U on scholarship, dream a career in metallurgy when he can blow things up. Rolls his sleeve to show me vibrant red and blue of coiled snake, his new tattoo. Strangely, every detail that used to make me jumpy and stop me in my tracks now racks me soothingly. My son came back to me. Thank you very much. Does anyone have a watch handy? What time is it?
6:14.
We have 1 minute for questions. Oh, come on. Come on. There's a question. One of our panelists has a question? The ladies' room is right down the hall. No, what? Oh, no. Did you hear that? Cheryl left out a whole page of her poem, Divine Affairs. Come on, we've got a minute. Read it. Come on. Read it.
Not at all. We want to hear it. We want to hear it.
Three things in wrong order, so you got the first and last. impressed, and I thought, yeah, well, that's an improvement.
It was nice.
I guess I didn't need the middle. Okay.
We'll be the judge.
Well, all right. See, now you're going to be disappointed. That's how that's going to work. Is that it? That's it.
Okay.
You remember the first part? That's divine affair. The whole thing, divine affair.
Okay.
Yes. You're very kind. In the lingering shadows of eternal afternoon tea, God carefully disrupts his melancholy. He materializes one translucent eye, arches the spine of his spirit, and breathes into space one soundless sigh. Even he was once a child, giving life to lumps of clay, but while in the hands of his divinity, clay became birds. In the hands of his infancy and his arrows, birds became prey. He shuts his weary eye to relive the moment when the Virgin Mary gave him life, delivered his curiosity into cold night air, denied the anesthesia of love that he, as man, might hoard an anesthesia of innocence. Okay, here's page 2. At once she appears, just small, balletic hands with which she paints a memory of blood red and roses, and as her sweet flowers fade into the starry depth of his startled eye, she brings herself fully into being, a moment to cry. She is fading to naught but thighs, a disappearing pirouette when God, alone in his study, ethereal fingers wrapped around cold china and tea, recalls her to a large leather chair where she, swinging the toes of her naked soul, proudly paints for him an illusion of fire in the hearth. He carries her attention to heights in view, heaven above, creation below. Look, says he. Bah, says she, and from her pout pours pigeons into rotting eaves. God, shrinking to a slit of an eye, spits out her fire and sends her reeling. He brings a foot into being and with an angry stride steps out of nothing, calls her to his side. She comes into focus, tour on lair, and leaves a trail of light fading where now she's made long shadows in a damp glade. He joins her there and succumbs to his defense. She, with a fleeting smile, breathes mushrooms on a split rail fence. Moonrise, nightfall, he leans her way. Behold, he whispers, what creatures do who are used to day. She conjures up box seats, and they, among the apathetic creatures of the night, watch two little humans, predator and prey. The beauty of them can hardly be denied, he proudly says aside, and she, applauding, replies, one dies. It made a difference? Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much.